All right, our final case for this morning is United States v. Malone, and we will hear again from Mr. Hillis.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Daniel Hillis. Again, I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office. I represent Mr. Malone in this case. He raises a single issue on appeal, and I feel as though I'm repeating myself, but it is an alleged breach by the government of the plea agreement. Contrary to what the government asserts, the agreement's appeal waiver does not bar this appeal, nor does the district court's finding that there was no breach prevent this appeal from going forward. Were those things to be legitimate bars, a defendant who suffers a breach can never get a district court's adverse determinations reviewed by this court, and that simply is not so. There is no allegation in this case akin to the allegations in the cases involving bad faith that is what happened. We are alleging a straight-out breach. We're not saying that there's something else that's amiss that then would allow us to squeeze our way around an appeal waiver.
I take it your position acknowledges that the whole thing is gone, that he might go to trial. If there were a new agreement, it would just have to be negotiated from scratch.
Indeed. Under Santabello, we'll have two potential remedies. My client has tried throughout, as the docket indicates, to get a new trial, and that's what so far he wishes. Should he change his opinion on that, he would be able to ask the district court for a lesser remedy of specific performance that would require the government to meet its obligation under the plea agreement. We wouldn't necessarily have to throw this out, but as things stand, he would like a new trial. And if there's a breach, the plea agreement goes out the window, as does the appeal waiver, and he would be able to elect that remedy under Santabello.
Now, the key move that you make is that the part of the plea agreement that stipulates the factual basis for the plea is really the same thing as a stipulation of the amount of loss and the number of victims and those sorts of things. But I think the reason the district judge was so nonplussed by that thought is that the factual basis for the plea is just understood to be, you know, I agree that the government can prove this much, but not that that's a ceiling on what the government can prove. The real business for the sentencing guidelines comes along later in the plea agreement.
Well, there is an enhancement with 10 or more victims, and so that, in my view, is part of the real business here. If we limit the total number of victims to 3, we avoid the two-level guideline enhancement, and, of course, an aggravating factor under 3553A would be the number of victims as well, which the district court clearly focused on, and I believe that's at appendix page 5.
No, I understand that, but you have to read this factual basis as the government's stipulation that this is a complete and exclusive list of the victims. And it's a little hard to do that. I mean, words like, for example, appear in it, one of these companies, and actually it names at least five, it names Modenier, WEX, J&C, Rick Reed, and Rural Metro. That's 5. I don't know. I mean, it's a stretch, I think.
Well, what wouldn't be a stretch is to ask the government to craft a more particularized plea agreement. If it doesn't want to give examples or it wants to say there are in excess
of... for example, though, what else do you want them to say?
There are these and more. There are in excess of...
Don't you think when you say, for example, you are implying that there are other examples out there?
Your Honor, my reading is not unique to me. Defense counsel was out of his chair.
And oh, sure. He objected instantly, yeah.
Right. So there has to be something to this that somebody else, some other lawyer at a different moment in time, said, this is contrary to my understanding. And he's the party who's involved in the negotiation of the plea agreement. So there is something about that, and I don't know if it comes in under parole evidence, if there's a hearing on this as to a breach. But there is somebody who negotiated this plea agreement who stated this is contrary to what we understood paragraph 9B of this plea agreement to do. it was a limitation. The government has now obliterated the limitation. The district courts accepted that evidence. This evidence has now been used to drive the sentence up in the fashion that it has. There's a two-level enhancement. It's articulated as an aggravating factor by the district court. Again, if this plea agreement is to be drafted by the government and the government wants to make sure that we avoid these sort of problems, all it has to do is put pen to paper or stroke keys on its keyboard, tighten these things up, say what it wants to say so we don't have ambiguities where trial counsel standing up and saying this is a breach, and on appeal we are saying again this is a breach. The government is in control of the plea agreement. It drafted what it did, and it was at least ambiguous in our view, and that ambiguity again under this court's decision in Williams should be held against the government. Let it draft a better plea agreement. We should be entitled to relief if there's ambiguity here. The plea agreement identified three victims of fraud, one victim of identity theft. That was a significant inducement to have my client plead guilty as opposed to go to trial. The government objected, or the defense objected to the argument, so we're under plain, the number of victims argument, so we're under plain, excuse me, under de novo review. And again, the government had a choice. It chose to draft the agreement that it did, and if it wished to draft a more particular agreement, it should have. But the way the agreement was drafted, the government should have been barred from arguing that there were more victims at a later juncture than what it put in the plea agreement that induced my client to sign the plea agreement and give up all of his rights in the first place and not to go to trial. As to the government's position in page 18 of its brief, that the ability to offer input is still appropriate, irrespective of what the plea agreement says. That eviscerates the plea agreement. What benefit does a party have, a defendant, in signing a plea agreement if there's a limitation on the number of victims, if the government can simply say that
but
they
the
have a
duty? But the problem is, there was never any limitation as to the number of victims for sentencing purposes. There was a description of the facts that your client was admitting to for purposes of accepting the guilty plea. And the paragraph in question is limited to that purpose. It doesn't have anything to do with sentencing, either explicitly, certainly not explicitly, and not implicitly either. Everybody knows what the factual basis is.
Sure, but I think that all plea agreements relate directly to sentencing. Those are things that are used as admissions against people later if they try to dispute relevant conduct and so forth.
But the guilt, too. I mean, you know, yes. Guilt and sentencing are often different.
Absolutely, but without a doubt, this petition to enter a guilty plea and including that specific language that it did as opposed to general language, the parties don't agree to the number of victims, the victims may be this many or more, things of that nature, I think that should be construed against the government, again, as the authoring party behind the plea agreement, a plea agreement that must be scrupulously honored, and a plea agreement.
But the district court didn't wind up giving that two-level increase. He takes the number of victims into account at 3553A, doesn't he?
It does, but it still moves the needle.
Yeah, but if it's not part of the guideline range, judges are entitled to take anything they want to into account, 3553A.
Indeed,
they
are.
I don't see anything in the plea agreement.
So long as the information doesn't come as a consequence of a breach. If the probation office wanted to tender that information to the district court for its consideration, not a breach. But if the government advocates for the use of that information to drive the sentence higher, then that would be a breach of a plea agreement. District courts can consider what they will under 3553A. It's a matter of the source. And if the context demonstrates a breach, then the district court should be precluded from hearing that evidence. Otherwise, again, what do people get for plea agreements when they sign them? They may as well blind plea. Unless the court has questions.
Yes. Were you involved in the plea agreement stage?
No. No, it was somebody in Indiana.
I just question.
Yes. No, I was not. Unless the court has further questions, I have nothing.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hose. Mr. Whalen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Nathaniel Whalen, and I'm here on behalf of the United States. Mr. Malone still has not pointed to a single portion of the plea agreement that contains the promise he alleges the government breached. There's no language in there that the government agrees there are only five victims, the government agrees only to present evidence of five victims, stipulates to five victims, and this is in stark contrast to other portions of the plea agreement, where the government agreed to dismiss a count, Mr. Malone agreed to remain in custody pending trial, the party stipulated to a loss amount. There's just nothing in the factual basis that imposes any obligation upon the government. As Chief Judge Wood noted, the language in the factual basis does contain numerous instances. For example, several companies, one of those companies, it's It's not language of limitation. It's not saying this is the universe of victims. Without any agreement along the lines that Mr. Malone alleges, there can't be a breach, and that's what the district court decided here. We think that's the end of the analysis, but if this court wants to go beyond the four corners of the document, it can look at the fact that Mr. Malone apparently didn't believe there was an agreement along the lines he now alleges. He alternatively argued there were 1, 2, 3, 4 victims, even though, again, as Chief Judge Wood noted, there are 5 enumerated victims in this actual basis. He pled guilty to stealing someone else's identity, someone not contained in the factual basis, so he knew there were more victims at play. And you know, with all due respect, he didn't object right away at the introduction of evidence of other victims.
Oh, his lawyer objects pretty promptly to the way this happens. I wouldn't go that way.
Well, Your Honor, he objects at the introduction of the 10 affidavits. But in the PSR, the government set forth the version of the events, and that included 8 victims not included in this factual basis. He didn't object to that. He said he agreed with the government's version of the events, and that included the 8 other victims.
But he makes his objection pretty clear on the record.
Oh, sure.
That this factual basis, I mean, the judge doesn't understand the factual basis in that limiting sort of way, and so he goes ahead and actually doesn't use, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he, although the PSR suggested the 10 or more victim enhancement for the guideline purpose, the judge doesn't do that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
He takes it into account at 3553A.
Ultimately, he imposed a 4-level variance, and one of the reasons he did was based on these 28 victims, but he did not apply the enhancement because he found they weren't victims as defined by the sentencing guidelines. Mm-hmm. You know, alternatively, the government believes this case should be dismissed pursuant to the appellate waiver, but unless this court has any questions, we would rest on our briefs on that issue.
Well, they're actually intertwined. The only way to get around the appeal waiver is to pierce the plea by prevailing on the breach claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think based on Hare and Whitlow and Sackler and the 3 cases we cite, this court doesn't even need to engage in the breach analysis because
I can't believe you're arguing that no matter how egregious the breach of a plea agreement, that if there's an appeal waiver in this breached agreement, the government is insulated from having to comply with the plea agreement?
No, I'm not arguing that, Your Honor. I'm arguing that the district court is the final arbiter of whether there was a breach when it was raised to him, just like it was in the 3 cases we cited. And the district court made an adjudication on this matter. What this court has said previously is when you sign these appeal waivers, what the defendant is doing is waiving his or her right to this 3-judge panel adjudicating the issue and is accepting the district court as the final adjudicator of the matter. I think, you know, there could be instances where there's a breach post-judgment where certainly this court has implied that that wouldn't be barred by the appeal waiver. That isn't this case. This is a case where the district court considered the issue, decided the issue, and any subsequent challenge is barred by the appellate waiver. Unless this court has any further questions, we would ask that you dismiss or alternatively affirm the sentence and judgment.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Hillis?
Win or lose the merits of this appeal, the most important thing now in my ears is to make sure that we emphasize the importance of rejecting the government's position about appeal waivers and about the district court being the final arbiter about whether or not there are breaches of plea agreements. That would put defendants in a terrible posture. No matter how egregious the breach, they would never have recourse so long as there's an appeal waiver, and God forbid there's a half-asleep judge at the bench not paying attention, not minding the store, and all sorts of terrible things come in. The government is able to assert on the appeal that there's an appeal waiver.
Like we did for how many years?
Well, I don't think those things ever happened, Judge. But it would just leave defendants without recourse, and that should not be the case. The purpose of this court is to review determinations of consequence, and this would certainly be one that's not barred by the appeal waiver under the particular circumstances. This is not one of those bad faith cases that this court has previously opined on. This is something different. This is an asserted breach of a contained term in the plea agreement. Lastly, as far as objecting to the plea agreement or to the PSR, no, my client never did that, but he did object at the sentencing hearing. fairly promptly. At the very least, better late than never. It's preserved the issue for appeal.
Mr. Hills, we appreciate you being here. You're an excellent advocate, but you seem to be arguing cases that are not in the district which you have an office.
Oh, we are privileged to be appointed on cases throughout the Seventh Circuit, so it's our great pleasure to come up.
Thank you. We appreciate the willingness of your office to do that very much. So thank you, and thank you to the government as well. We'll take the case under advisement.